This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Scientific visionary Francis Crick passed away Wednesday after a battle against colon cancer. He was 88 years old. In 1953, together with James Watson, he deciphered the structure of the DNA molecule that he triumphantly claimed was the secret of life. And with that, the field of molecular biology and the future of genetic engineering was born. Watson, Crick, and their collaborator Maurice Wilkins were awarded the 1962 Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine for the discovery of the double helix. James Watson said of Crick this week, quote, "I will always remember Francis for his extraordinarily focused intelligence and for the many ways he showed me kindness and developed my self-confidence. Sharing with him our office in the Cavendish Laboratory of Cambridge University was an extraordinary privilege." The son of a shoemaker, Francis Crick started his career as a physicist before turning his mind to the problems of biology. After discovery of the double helix, Crick went on to figure out how DNA is translated into the proteins, the building blocks of cells, through RNA. In 1977, Crick turned his thoughts to matters of the mind, and working at the Salk Institute, spent much of his career searching for a molecular understanding of consciousness. Here to tell us more about Francis Crick and his work is his longtime colleague and friend, Dr. Leslie Orgel, resident fellow and research professor at the Salk Institute for Biological Sciences in La Jolla, California. He joins us by phone from his office. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Orgel.
Thank you.
What do you remember most about Dr. Crick?
I think he was an incredibly intelligent scientist who could sum up situations very rapidly, see the key questions that arose, and more than anyone else I've known, go ahead and provide solutions for them in a substantial proportion of cases.
Did he suffer fools gladly, or did he cut them to the quick if he did not agree with them?
Well, people's lives change, their styles change. I think he was maybe a bit brash in his early days and certainly didn't suffer fools gladly at any time, but I think he was rather gentle with people later on in his career.
Mm-hmm. We had the Francis Crick and the James Watson duo. What were, in your view, the differences in style and character and way of doing work between the two?
I think Jim was probably very intuitive. He grew up as a biologist, while Francis was probably a bit more analytical because he grew up through physics. And so I'm sure that Francis, in the DNA structure, probably was the person who understood the mathematics of how you solve crystal structures and so on far better than Jim did. But it was Jim's intuition that put the bases together in the right way that made the solving of the structure possible. They were a formidable combination.
In fact, it is Crick who is credited with that famous line of walking into the pub and saying, we have solved the riddle of life, the secret of life. Did he actually say that?
Well, I wasn't there, so I don't know, but it seems to me entirely possible.
Uh-huh. Well, what did he do later on after he had won the Nobel Prize years later? How did he turn his life? What did he turn it to?
Well, he did things that would have made anybody famous quite independent of the DNA structure. I think amongst his major discoveries in molecular biology was the adapter hypothesis. People, for example, thought that when RNA guided the synthesis of proteins, it did so by a direct interaction between the amino acids that make up the proteins and the nucleotides that make up the RNA. And Francis, with incredible intuition, said, no, that wasn't the way it was going to work. There would be some other molecule that went in between, that interacted with the RNA and then picked up the amino acids. And one of the most remarkable predictions in molecular biology, and of course it turned out to be exactly right when people discovered what we now call the transfer RNAs, which are exactly the adapters that Francis hypothesized. Mm-hmm. Now let's think of some of the other things he did. The three-letter code, together with Sidney and Seymour Banza, they ingenious series of experiments that led to the proof that the code went from three bases to one amino acid. I think it was probably the last really solid series of experiments that Francis ever did, checking out and developing that theory. Of course, more recently, he's changed his scientific field totally, and now has worked for the last 15 years, I imagine, on how the brain functions. Now, this is still work in progress. One doesn't know how it's going to come out, but he has had an enormous influence on attracting scientists to the field by sort of making it rather a respectable field, where it was considered rather a sort of borderline form of madness, I think, before he went into it.
Do you think he used his training as a physicist to see, I think I can, looking for hardwiring of the brain?
No, I don't think so at all. No, I don't think so. I think he hasn't approached it as a physicist at all. He's approached it much more from the point of view of someone interpreting complex experiments on a very messy sort of subject.
Outside of the lab, in the public arena, he seemed to be a quiet man. He hardly ever gave we journalists an interview, but that was something a little bit different inside the lab, correct?
Yes, indeed. I mean, he really was intensely interested in science, very interested in many other things, but not really very interested in giving general talks to people, except to people, you know, he could discuss with at a professional level. Quite different at dinner parties, where he was happy to explain anything to anybody. But I don't think he liked going out and talking for long. He wouldn't have liked doing what I'm doing now.
as opposed to James Watson, who loves doing what you're doing now.
Exactly so. They were very different personalities.
And Watson has said that one of his main motivations for deciphering DNA was to take religion or God out of the equation of life, that science itself could explain life. Did Crick share this ideal?
I'm absolutely sure that Francis believed that, but I doubt that it was a major motivation. In Francis' case, I think that he wanted to know how the biological world worked. He was convinced that it could be understood rationally without appeal to supernatural intervention. But I suspected the driving force was wanting to understand how biology worked and not sort of proving that some other theory about the origins of and evolution of the biosphere was incorrect. I think he just wanted to know how it worked.
Yeah. In 1981, you and Crick wrote a book called Life Itself.
No, that isn't correct.
Isn't that right?
No, Francis wrote the book.
I see.
I discussed it with him
at some
point.
Oh, you just discussed it? Tell us what that book was about. What any new ideas in that book?
Well, the thing that journalists love to pick on, I suspect, is the panspermia idea. But I don't think I was involved with Francis, and it was not a very serious suggestion. I think he saw it as a possibility, and one that would attract attention to what the main purpose of the book was, which was to try to explain in a simple way the views then, as of 1980-odd, on how life originated. And if you read the book, you'll find that panspermia really plays rather a small part of it. I can't tell you what percentage, maybe 10 or 20%. And it's pretty much an account at the time of the origin of life. But Francis was perfectly clear that he thought it was a possible option. I don't think he ever believed it was the most likely way that life got onto the Earth, but he would have quite insisted that no one could prove that it wasn't, and until somebody did, it remained an option.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Judy in San Francisco, hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, I'm so glad you're having this program. However, I was surprised this was not included in your introduction about Mr. Crick. that in addition to his many important contributions to scientific inquiry and discovery, he also engaged in very serious intellectual theft, denying the critically important contributions to scientific inquiry and discovery made by his female colleagues, and in effect stealing her ideas and her discoveries, which were necessary and critical to his and Watson's, quote, discovery of the double helix, failing to give her credit, failing to acknowledge her credibility as a scientist, et cetera. And I just find it ironic, actually, not to sully his memory too much, but that in talking about perhaps he wanted to, along with Watson, take religion and God out of the inquiry into what is life, that perhaps he took some of the ethics out of the process of scientific method and scientific process. So I'm wondering if you could talk about that legacy, in addition to his wonderful legacy, contributing to what we know about life today and our brains, also the unfortunate legacy of sexism and of intellectual dishonesty.
I'm surprised a woman, you know, you never mentioned her name, Rosalind Franklin. You didn't feel like you needed to mention it either, I can see.
Well,
Dr. Crick,
excuse me,
sure. My turn. Dr. Crick, would you like to comment on that?
You mean Dr. Orgel?
I'm sorry, Dr. Orgel.
Yes.
Would you like to comment on that?
Yeah, well, I think Francis was an intensely honest man. I don't think that he attempted in any way to do Rosalind down, and I think if you read his more recent remarks, you'll find they're very fair. Now, the person who's dealt with this, in my opinion, most fairly is a man called Aaron Klug, who's made a very careful analysis of the notebooks and everything. The conclusion certainly is that they depended on her results to a considerable extent. Although the results had been discussed at a lecture before, I believe, and were in a sense open. But nonetheless, they did make use of her results. Mm-hmm. But I don't think Francis has ever attempted to deny that. And I'm not aware of his ever saying anything bad about Rosalind.
No,
perhaps the person who was talking is confusing the two.
Yeah, we've done two or three shows on this topic with Rosalind Franklin and various authors who have written about her history. And none of them have ever mentioned James Watson they like to pick on, but not Francis.
I've never heard these claims made about Crick before, although I have heard them made, and I can't say, you know, I've never investigated them. I've heard such things said about Jim Watson, which I don't believe, but I've heard them said. But this is the first time that I've heard anybody say this about Francis Crick.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. We're talking about Francis Crick with my guest, Dr. Leslie Orgel from the Salk Institute. Did he study other things at Salk with you besides?
He was an old friend of mine way back since 64, I imagine, and we traveled together and we talked about just about everything.
Did he get into the chemical evolution of life there also?
Yes, I mean, we talked about it endlessly, and in fact we published two papers side by side because it was very hard for us to know who had suggested what because we talked so much about it, and so we decided we'd split them up and he'd talk about the evolution of protein synthesis and I'd talk about the evolution of life, but
Dr. Orgel,
he contributed enormously.
We've run out of time. Thank you very much for joining us, Dr. Leslie Orgel of the Salk Institute in La Jolla, California. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. Don't go away. From fresh fruit and veggies to processed ready-to-eat meals, chances are that the food that you buy in your regular shopping trip has been at least considered by a food technologist somewhere along the line. If not engineered somehow, the plastic bag that holds the spring mix, the pasteurized process for fresh milk, that reddish orange, well, salmon color in the flesh of farmed salmon, all of it has been carefully developed and tested by food technologists. And earlier this month at the 2004 Institute of Food Technologists, meeting and the Food Expo. Thousands of people gathered to discuss their latest advances in all sorts of food technologies and, of course, the direction of the food industry. What is new in food technology? That's what we're going to be talking about this hour. If you have a question or comment, give us a call. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let me introduce my guest. Charlie Santerre is an associate professor at the Department of Foods and Nutrition at Purdue University. He's also a science communicator with the Institute of Food Technologists. He joined us now by phone from his office in West Lafayette, Indiana. Welcome to the show, Dr. Santerre.
Good afternoon, Ira.
Tell us, you were at that meeting of the 2004 Institute of Food Technologists a couple of weeks ago. Is there a definition of food technology that you use generally?
Generally, we look at food technology as anything that pretty much occurs after harvest of a fruit or vegetable or harvest of an animal. Mm-hmm. The process that goes on after production and before consumers will consume it.
Give us an idea. We're going to have you be our roving reporter, at least after the fact. what did you see? What are some of the new technologies, new foods that were being shown there?
Well, there are a lot of things going on. One of the things that we're trying to get more of in the American diet is omega-3 fatty acids.
Right.
So several companies were looking at technologies for getting these healthy fats into foods and still keeping the foods tasting as good as they did before they added them, or even better in some cases.
Well, we've seen eggs in the grocery store that have additional omega-3 in them.
That's correct. In the next 5 years, we'll probably see mayonnaise that would have it, some frozen foods that would have it. Many of our meat products may have it. So we'll be able to successfully increase the intake of this for most consumers.
Is this going to be by adding it to the food that the animals eat?
There are different ways of doing it. You can add it to the animal's food. One way that's being done right now with, say, farm salmon is it's added into the feed of the salmon. Eventually, we'll start doing more of that with poultry and swine and beef and dairy. Some of that's going on now. But soon, we'll start to create new crops that will have these healthy fats in them. And we'll either eat those crops ourselves or we'll feed those crops to animals and then we'll eat the animals.
1-800-989-8255. We're talking about food technology, 1-800-989-TALK. And if you'd like to talk about new food technology, please do that with us. Other technologies, other new things you saw at the fair?
Well, there's a lot of work going on in food irradiation now.
Is that still not a dirty word, or still is a dirty word?
In the U.S., it's become more and more accepted.
Yeah.
As consumers have been able to go to grocery stores and buy irradiated meats, take them home and see how they last in their refrigerator and how they're safer, they've adopted them quite soundly.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact is, if we irradiate 50% of our meat products, we can reduce foodborne illness by a million or more individuals, with maybe even a reduction in deaths by about 400 a year.
Mm-hmm.
So the benefits for irradiation, and it's not much different than pasteurization or most of the other processes that go on in the treatment of foods.
Let's talk about packaging for a second. I think we've seen the death of the tin can, have we not?
No, I think the tin can will be around for as long as you and I are.
Oh, really?
But there are some things that are pretty exciting. If you go in the grocery stores now, you can find these foil-pouched fish products. And I really like the foil-pouched salmon product because it doesn't have much drain and it's much higher quality. You basically eat all of the contents of this.
Mm-hmm.
But we've put foil liners in many of our packages to help keep the oxygen out and to give them more shelf life, keep them fresher.
Mm-hmm.
We've modified the atmosphere inside of packages to control the amount of oxygen and carbon dioxide, and that also helps to protect the flavor and aroma, everything that you enjoy about a product.
You know, I'm fascinated by these salads that come in bags.
Yeah.
They're not just plain plastic wrapping, are they?
In some cases, they could be, but in most cases, they are a package that helps protect that environment to keep that lettuce from wilting and spoiling. So you can actually buy it all ready to go, and it'll have a shelf life of several days by the time you get it home.
Mm-hmm. There was a new space food packaging technology presented at the meeting, and I'm laughing because it's such an old technology. What could you have new about Tang or whatever they're making that's freeze-dried?
Well, we have to come up with some new techniques if we're going to be able to put astronauts on Mars. The trip to Mars is expected to take anywhere up to 2.5 years. So we have to have foods that can be shelf-stable for that long.
Mm-hmm.
Now, typically, you go in a grocery store and you buy, say, a breakfast cereal, a dry product. That's expected shelf life is about a year. But we can't afford to send our astronauts up there and have things spoil halfway before they return to Earth. So there's real challenges in how we handle those products. There are many bigger issues with how we maintain the astronauts' bone density and things like that when they're in weightless when they're in a weightless environment. But there are also challenges on the food side, is how do we get them foods that they'll be willing to eat for 2.5 years? And these typically won't be those things that you and I would eat for breakfast or lunch
right.
or dinner.
Well, what about protecting it from radiation that you know we don't normally have here? If you store it somewhere in a closet in a
yes.
spaceship, it's going to get its own sort of radiation.
Yes. Yes, that's one of the more difficult problems. As we go into the outer atmospheres, we get more radiation from the sun, and these can cause the fats that are present in our foods to oxidize or turn rancid. So the worst-case scenario would be to have a food product spoil after only about 2 months of space flight. And so scientists are looking at ways to use packaging in one case to offer a screen for that irradiation, but also have products that would be stable if they were radiated by the sun.
Mm-hmm. Kathleen in Washington, D.C., welcome to Science Friday. Fine.
Okay. This is going to be a little bit intricate, but here's the situation I'm in. I'm an applied anthropologist, and there's an issue with women, especially in the Hispanic population, of neural tube defects, you know, like spina bifida, et cetera. Well, it turns out that there's a mold that grows on corn called fumonisins. And it blocks folic acid. So, and they've already determined that folic acid helps in terms of these abating these neural tube defects. So, one question is: there's an old way of making tortilla that sort of a nixtamalization that cuts through this mold. And my question is: is there some sort of trade-off in terms of cultural ways of dealing with food? Let's say the old folks that did it the old way knew what they were doing, you know, versus some of the new ways, such that you're adding more folic acid to, let's say, corn products or something, so that you have this ability to do the trade-off between health and issues about health, as well as bringing the foods up to speed.
Dr. Santer?
Well, Kathleen brings up a good point. But one other point I'd like to add to her discussion, her observation, is that oftentimes these molds that are present in some of our grain crops were not detected for many years. Another one like aflatoxin that is a mycotoxin-producing mold that
right.
can show up on corn
sure.
had been there for many, many years, and we just didn't know much about it. And this can be very toxic.
What I understand, it's 1988 in South Africa that they really began to realize that this fumonisins were actually present.
Yes, true. And some of the technology we're doing with food biotechnology is offering alternatives to that by putting in proteins that are toxic to insects, for instance. We're able to reduce the amount of injury that occurs on the corn plant in the U.S., and by reducing that injury that's caused by insects, we reduce the amount of molds that can grow on the corn plant. So there are some of these new technologies that will help to reduce the mold proliferation on the corn plant, but also this new technology will allow us to add more folic acid to the corn itself so that we'll have a better source of folic acid.
Wonderful.
Thanks for calling, Kathleen.
Thank you.
Bye. Have you noticed any backlash against genetically modified foods in the States? Here, farmers are rebelling against growing them because they're having trouble selling them overseas.
Well, there's a difficulty in selling in Europe primarily, but typically the American consumer has been very very supportive of food biotechnology. In the U.S., we're very embracing of new technologies anyway. We look at computer technology or communication technology or air travel. We've always been on the forefront of adopting these new technologies. So that's not really been a problem in the United States, especially now that consumers are really seeing the benefits from these things, that we're starting to have crops that have fewer allergens in there. And anybody who's ever had a child with a severe allergy would like to be able to feed them without having to worry about everything they eat. Well, we're probably about 20 or 30 years away from that point. But being able to have less pesticides applied to our crops is another advantage that consumers really like. So by and large, the American consumer has been very happy to embrace these. Now, the European community has been more reticent to do this, to embrace these, partly because they were not on the forefront of developing these crops. And there are many other reasons involved.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of other reasons involved. We won't get into that right now. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to Paul in Low Pass, Oregon.
Hi, Ira. How are you?
Hi there.
Hey, I'd like to ask about an old-time technology, old in my lifetime. I'm middle-aged. You know, what about the food colorings, you know, like in M&M's, you know, Blue Lake 9 and red this and, you know, I was eating those for decades before I read the package. You know, what is the safety record, or have these things ever been tested, these dyes?
Yes, food dyes have to go through between 6 and 8 years of testing to make sure they're safe. Matter of fact, the food colorants are probably some of the most tested food additives that we have in our food supply. And so you can be pretty confident that the federal agencies, the Food and Drug Administration and the U.S. Department of Agriculture, has really taken a close look at these. In addition, scientists and many academic institutions have also looked at these to show that they are safe to consume.
What are they actually made out of?
There's various ways of getting them. Some come from natural plants, and then some are chemically synthesized, much like many of the things that would naturally occur in your foods. In that case, though, that Mother Nature produces them out in the field with some sunshine, some rainfall, and some fertilizer.
Thanks for calling, Paul.
Thanks.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's move right along here with Sam in Palo Alto. Hi, Sam.
Hi, how are you?
Hi there.
I have a question. If there is any information about technologies for reducing trans fats without sacrificing flavor or shelf life?
I missed that. Reducing what?
Reducing trans fats in foods, fatty acids.
Yes. There's been a lot of activity. Actually, on the expo floor of the Institute of Food Technologists meeting that just occurred in Las Vegas, many food companies are trying to get trans fats out of their products. Because of a new labeling requirement that will be implemented in the year 2006. Mm-hmm. So, yes, I would predict that many or most of the trans fats that are in our food supply now will be removed by 2006 because processors do not want to show those on the label.
Well, that's great news. Thanks.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
We've seen also the soaring price of salmon. And I saw a story the other day that Alaska salmon men are just tickled pink, so to speak, because they're getting, you know, $3 a pound where they were getting 50 cents a pound before, because people are afraid to eat, you know, farm-raised salmon. And now they're getting the fresher, you know, there's a better market for the natural salmon.
Well, there's been a big debate about salmon in the last couple years. There are some groups who are upset because their markets have been undercut. For instance, the wild salmon from up in Alaska brings premium value in the grocery stores, and it's only available for a few months of the year. That industry has been dramatically impacted because we can now raise salmon in pens in British Columbia, for instance, or in pens down in Chile. And so there have been some groups that haven't liked the fact that we raise salmon because it's been hard on them financially. But most scientific studies now support the fact that farm salmon is very safe, very nutritious. It's actually one of the ideal foods to eat if you want to get the long-chain omega-3 fatty acids into your diet.
We're talking about food technology this hour at Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Although their safety warnings have gone out about how much salmon you should be eating every week or per week.
Well, there's been a couple groups, but by and large, the American Medical Association and these type of organizations have supported the fact that we can save many, many lives in the U.S. As many as 100,000 lives could be saved in the U.S. from sudden cardiac death if we got middle-aged consumers, to eat more salmon, whether it be farmed or wild.
Or you could just take an omega-3 pill.
Yeah, you could. There are some slight difficulties with taking a supplement. You get a little bit of a reflux, a lot of people do, from taking a supplement. Plus, you lose the enjoyment of eating the fish itself. Plus, there's also other parts of the salmon, the carotenoids that are in there that give it its characteristic color that are very healthy for us also.
Mm-hmm.
So you never get the same taking a supplement as you would eating a whole food is basic premise for food technologists.
Any changes you saw, you know, in the size and the shape of the food so that they package better? You know, over the years we've watched tomatoes decline in taste so that they can make them firmer and square or whatever shape to fit better in the truck that ships them 4,000 miles from one part of the country to the other?
Well, I guess I would disagree with you a little bit there. I think that the quality of tomatoes in the wintertime have improved dramatically from what I remember 20 years ago.
Because they're coming from South America?
Maybe they're coming from South America, yes. And that's part of the benefits of having an international economy when it comes to food production and processing, is that you can eat strawberries in the middle of February in Indiana, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
So we have many, many more choices. For instance, back in 1969, when you went to the grocery store, the number of choices you might have had would be somewhere around 7,000. Today you go to a grocery store and you've got 50,000 choices. So you can really pick those things which are the freshest, that taste the best, and you've got a lot more variety to get a healthy diet.
Mm-hmm. So what would I got about a minute left. Anything that we should watch for in the future, any cutting-edge food technology?
Well, there's a lot going on in organic foods, lot of discussion on organic foods. Some people are showing that there are some benefits in some cases, and there's some disadvantages in some cases. I would say that the most exciting research right now is going on related to the healthy fats, and including increasing those in our diet. And you'll see a lot more dedicated toward reducing obesity in this country, since 2 out of 3 in the U.S. are either overweight or obese. Food technologists are taking this very seriously and trying to offer options for those people trying to keep their weight in check.
And as far as low-carb foods, then?
There's quite a bit in low-carbs. I consider that to be a little bit more of a fad. I'm not sure that'll continue. Most science is starting to show that the Atkins diet, it really works only because it reduces total caloric intake. So it's not much different than other diets. But we're learning that we have to really improve our lifestyle by exercising more if we really want to keep our weight in check.
Well, a topic for another discussion. Thank you very much for joining us, Charlie. Charlie Santerre is an associate professor at the Department of Foods and Nutrition at Purdue University. He's also a science communicator with the Institute of Food Technologists. Thanks for being with us.
Good to be with you, Ira.
We're going to take a break, come back, and switch gears. When we come back, we're going to talk about stem cell research. You know, it's a hot topic. There's some new interesting research going on having to do with neurology. So stay with us. We'll be right back.